Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 573rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice sport at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And as always, not always, but we often will invite guests to speak because I know you guys are going to find this not an evidence-based statement, but Mike and I don't know everything.
The word, not everything, anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I always get those words confused. But we today we have Jamie Falk with us, who we've had on a few podcasts before. Jamie, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks. Always a pleasure to be on the podcast. So I am an associate professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of Manitoba, and I practice as a clinical pharmacist at the Department of Family Medicine.
Yeah. And Jamie's always, I've known Jamie for years and years, and always is able to take, you know, relatively complicated information, put it together in a way to, that we can understand it in a simple way. And if there's an area that, is tricky, to say the least, it's the treatment of depression. And not only are we talking about depression in this one, we're going to talk about difficult to treat depression. And then is there any benefit from using antipsychotics? Because they are used not infrequently, but they're used for lots of things. But there's a thought that they may help difficult to treat depression. And you guys had a look at this.
Yeah, it's it's a big area of study. Mm-hmm. There are lots and lots of randomized trials here. There are lots of systematic reviews. So we jumped in with both feet. I had two PharmD students who I had the pleasure of working with, super keen students, Wyatt Ballone and Bradley Ledrew, and I think they dove in deeper into antipsychotics than they ever expected they would.
Yeah, for sure.
Alex Singer, who's a family doc and researcher here in Manitoba as well. So yeah, it was a fun process.
Yeah, no, for sure. So why don't you just run us through is there a reason why we think they would work? And then I guess let's go over the evidence.
Right. You want some pharmacological.
Well, no, I'm saying, I was going to get into this later, but we know that, you know, when you treat depression with an antidepressant, and I don't really care how or if they work, you know, about 50% of people, within 6 to 8 weeks will say they're no longer depressed on the drug, but it's about 40% on placebo. So that means that a lot of people don't necessarily benefit from our basic antidepressants. And so that's why antipsychotics have been added in. And I don't know. If you know the mechanism, you're in the wrong spot, Jamie, because you could be making a lot more money doing this. But the thought is sort of going to another class of drugs to see if it can help.
Yeah. And so through the years, they've looked at, do you switch antidepressants? Yeah. Do you add other antidepressants on? Do you increase the dose of current antidepressants? Mm-hmm. The advent of the, what I think some people call the atypical antipsychotic or the second generation or the third generation antipsychotics, whatever the case, the belief was based on how they work, that they may provide some reduction in depression, particularly in those who've had trials of a previous agent. Usually those, I think for the most part, is going to be an SSRI or sometimes an SNRI as a first choice. And those who have had an inadequate response, the idea was, do we add an atypical antipsychotic on top of that if you get a partial response?
Yeah, no, perfect. So just run us through the evidence, because there are some RCTs.
There are. Yeah. So we, because of the large amount of systematic reviews based on a good number of RCTs, we looked at the last 5 years of systematic reviews and found five of them. And that's looking at, again, there's a lot of different inclusion criteria in these systematic reviews. So it ranges anywhere from about 2,000 to just over 8,000 patients total in each of these systematic reviews. And There's a difference in definition of what is, again, whether we call it difficult to treat depression or treatment resistant depression is a lot of the words in the past literature. And generally, it was at least one past antidepressant treatment failure, so an inadequate response, to two, but some definitions say you should have at least two. So right there, we get a bit of a difference in what we're kind of looking at. What we would think, and again, this is probably a bit of an assumption, but the more drugs that a patient has not done well on, probably the less likely they are to do well on the future drug. I think that's probably the way we think.
Yeah. I remember reading about this before when I used to present on antidepressants and depression treatment. And I remember being struck by kind of how sequential things were. So James talked about it's anywhere between 40 to 50 response to placebo and mm-hmm. 50 to 60 mm-hmm. to drug in the first round. And then the second round, it would drop in both groups. So the placebo, you were less likely to respond, but even in the treatment arm. And every single, I remember the one I was looking at was a meta-analysis that went for, I think it was to the third round of treatment. And every time the effectiveness, the chance of getting a benefit went down in both groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it makes sense to, you know, I think the last thing you do, and I'm just going back to a different area, you wouldn't give a beta blocker and then go, oh, that didn't work, and give another beta blocker, and then give another beta blocker. I mean, it makes sense to try something that might pharmacologically be at least somewhat different, with the caveat, we don't know how any of these drugs work. So what do they find there, Jamie?
Right. So when we looked at the systematic reviews, there were four key antipsychotics that came up and made up about 90% of the volume of patients mm-hmm. in these RCTs. So aripiprazole, brexpiprazole, cariprazine, and quetiapine. And risperidone made up about 5% of the total volume. So a very, very small amount of data coming from risperidone. And at about 6 to 8 weeks, so again, this is one of those problems, I think, with antidepressant trials is they last for about 6 to 8 weeks at follow-up. And so when they looked at response rates, and by response, most of the studies would have defined that as having at least a 50% reduction in depression score. And I think to go prior to that, you can find a lot of resources that say when you're at this stage where you're trying to find the right thing to add on, generally the clinically important difference isn't there across the population that studied. So they look for the responders. And so when you look at the percentage of responders in these studies, somewhere between what we found was about 24 to 37% of patients who got adjunct antipsychotics had a response versus about 18 to 27% in placebo. So, you know, if you want to kind of ballpark it, 30% response in those that got the adjunct compared to about 20% or so in the placebo group, and the placebo group getting whatever it was that they were, you know, kind of established on, usually an SSRI.
And that's the numbers needed to treat of 10. And that's exactly kind of what you said, Mike. You'd have probably seen somewhat similar numbers if you were to try a second antidepressant.
Yeah, that kind of number or slightly less. If you've tried and things haven't gone well on preceding antidepressants, when you try another one, the NNTs gradually get a little worse over time. Yeah. The absolute percent benefit gets a little worse, kind of going from 10 to 8 to, you know, that kind of thing.
And then they also looked at remission though, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so here, again, we see what kind of Mike was talking about before with the placebo or control group. We're talking about rates of 12 to 18% of people going into remission. With response, it was 18 to 27%. So James, you were saying, you know, 40% mm-hmm. in kind of first time antidepressant trials, but we're getting a lower and lower percentage of people responding. So about 12 to 18% in the placebo group and about 17 to 30% remission in the add-on group. So again, that's a number needed to treat of 10, but depending where you look, up to about 22. And that's where we saw some of this data where it's very difficult to say, well, which of these, if we're going to use an antipsychotic as adjunct, which one would be a better one? And it's almost impossible to tell. When you look at the inclusion criteria, how they defined difficult to treat depression, a whole bunch of other things about just, you know, what were the treatment phases, what was the concurrent treatment underneath the agents that we're using. So it's difficult to tell, but again, somewhere in a number needed to treat range of 10 to 22.
And then you did have some individual drug findings, I guess.
Yeah. So when we looked at quetiapine and cariprazine, it was either inconsistent, meaning we had some studies that said, yes, better than placebo, others said no, or just non-significant results. And then when we looked at risperidone, as I mentioned before, it just makes up about 300 patients. And that was in one RCT that was a pretty high risk of bias. It was tough to believe the results, but mm-hmm. risperidone on paper looked the best with, you know, a number needed to treat of about 6, but we really found it hard to believe that was actually the case based on that one trial that we had found a lot of problems with.
And so that's pretty much the evidence of effectiveness. And the nice thing, and you guys both know it, antipsychotics don't cause any side effects. So we don't.
Yeah, they're so clean. They're such a clean drug.
Yes, wow. There is. So I'm just looking at the tools of practice. The size of the amount of discussion, the adverse effects is actually larger visually than the benefit. So why don't you run us through that? Because I think that's an important thing as well.
It is, and I think we devoted that much space to the tools for practice because of the kind of dirtiness, and we didn't want what we believe is going to be a benefit for some people to be to not be. I mean, we need that other balance picture. Mm-hmm. And discontinuation due to adverse events, which I think is always a good outcome to look at, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in RCTs, you know, you're in a trial, you're committed to a trial, you have someone calling you fairly frequently, you're probably going to stay in more likely than you would in real practice. But whatever the case, when we look at discontinuation, about 3 to 10% of people in the antipsychotic group discontinued due to adverse events, and about 1 to 3% in placebo. So those numbers are fairly small, but you can also look at it as about a 3 to 4 times higher chance of stopping due to adverse mm-hmm. events than in placebo.
Yeah, and the absolute increase is about the same size as the absolute benefit.
Hmm.
You know, depending on what numbers you use.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it may be a little bit less, but not much.
Right. Yeah. Some important ones that we looked at, and we intentionally didn't want to cherry pick the ones we wanted to look at from an adverse event standpoint, but the ones that came up most commonly and had the most robust data behind them, one of them was akathisia, and so about 8 to 20% versus about 2 to 6% in placebo. And those of you that have looked at the aripiprazole literature know that it's probably going to rank highest, and it did with a number needed to harm of about 7 for akathisia, whereas something like quetiapine was very similar to placebo.
Right.
But then you go to something like somnolence, where you've got an incidence of, again, about 4 to 19-20% versus 1 to 5% in placebo. And quetiapine there has the lowest number needed to harm. And again, if you've worked with quetiapine, that may not come as a surprise, whereas something like aripiprazole was similar to placebo. So, you know, it's you're kind of trading off side effects depending on which drug you're using.
Yeah. And some of these would have led to discontinuation, but this is not necessarily, was it, they were not necessarily being discontinued because of that. This is just, it may be on top of.
That's right.
Some of the other
That's
side right. effects that we've talked about. And when you say it's a small numbers needed to harm, that's actually worse.
Yes, right.
Yeah, contextually, yeah. Even though it sounds, it's always, I've always struggled with the numbers needed to harm or I don't even like numbers needed to treat. So I want to make sure it actually is making akathisia worse.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A 7, if you only need to treat 7 people before you've harmed one versus mm-hmm. some of the other drugs at 20, you have to treat 20 people to harm one.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, the small number is the worst number in NNH.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other one we looked at was weight gain, which is always comes up. And certainly patients that I work with, if you ask them what side effects do you want to avoid, mm-hmm. weight gain often comes up. Not that they'd want akathisia, but knowing about weight gain, they bring it up. And so oddly enough, and we couldn't find the answer to this, but The systematic review that gave us most of our data on this outcome looked at a body weight gain of greater than or equal to 7%. So I'm not sure why they chose that, but they did. And it was about 4 to 8% in the adjunct atypical antipsychotic group compared to 1 to 3%. So if you look at some of the key RCTs in these systematic reviews, it was about 5 kilograms would have been about 7% of body weight based on the body weight. So 5 kilograms, you have about a 2 to 4 fold higher chance of gaining 5 kilograms compared to just not being on the antipsychotic.
Yeah. So
I have two potential reasons for that, Jamie. The first being somewhat funny, that the committee, the people running the trial, probably said, should we do 5 or 10? And, being stewards of compromise, they decided to go for 7. Right. But I think probably the bigger thing is if you made it a harder criteria to get to, then less people are going to get to it, and the number needed to harm is going to be bigger. So the differences will be small between the two groups. Like if you say how many gained in 6 weeks, how many of them gained 7% of their weight, it might actually be a bit hard to get there.
Yeah.
And so it ends up being helpful. And like if they set the criteria at 5, they probably have more people. So they probably backed off.
They'd also have an increase in the number of people who got there on placebo. So it's
tricky. Yeah, but not to the same degree, right? If you set the criteria harder if you want to keep the difference between placebo and treatment, especially if you know, like if it's something like somnolence.
Yeah.
Sleeping 6 hours a day, that would be your criteria, and then you can't actually. Very few people can actually get 6 hours of extra sleep, especially if they have kids. So you set these criteria knowing that it helps control the message.
Yeah. Right. And then now the weight gain, it varied somewhat depending on the drug, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. So aripiprazole had the lowest number needed to harm. Quetiapine next, brexpiprazole next. Mm-hmm. But again, these numbers needed to harm were fairly large. And again, 19 for aripiprazole, 34 for quetiapine. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of people to treat, but it is 5 kilograms of weight. And as Mike said, it's only over 6 to 8 weeks. And I think that got, us to start thinking about what does this do in the long term for patients, right?
Yeah.
Knowing that, we've certainly got data in the schizophrenia population where they're using generally higher doses than this for long periods of time. And we see not only the weight gain, but the other metabolic effects that go along with that. Mm-hmm. And that's just not something that was, that we're able to pick up with this type of thing. And you would just expect these numbers to go up over time, right?
Yeah, no, we've seen patients, Jamie, I know you've seen them too, where they're on these drugs at high doses for, a year at a time, and they, not all patients, obviously, but some gain a massive amount of weight and the consequences of that. And then those are the ones where you're like, especially if you struggle to find a medicine that works for their psychiatric illness, and this one's working, but it's causing these awful harms. I remember many cases debating what to do in these because the conditions can be so devastating. That includes depression, but in the case of schizophrenia.
Absolutely right.
So that's the best available evidence with all the numbers, but there, as with always, there's limitations to this.
Yeah. I think this comes up a lot in the tools that we put together, that most of the RCTs were industry funded. I mentioned this before, varying definitions of what treatment resistance is. And again, if one of the risperidone study, they did an open run of 4 weeks on the antidepressant that the patient came in on after consent. And if they were found to not be adequately controlled on 4 weeks, they got randomized to risperidone. And so that's a case of you just did poorly on one agent for 4 weeks, whereas others required a failure of at least two other agents. Large differences there. And then inconsistent reporting is as well. Olanzapine is probably a drug that maybe people that are listening are thinking, what about olanzapine? And if you look at the most recent Cochrane review, they report it, but it's a trial of 20 patients. And when we're looking at quetiapine and cariprazine and aripiprazole and those types of things, we're looking at 800 to 1,200, 2,000 patients. So it's very hard to take a trial of 20 patients seriously.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. So that's basically the evidence that we have. As always with our tools of practice, we give a context. So do you want to help us out with that? Because there's more to the decision making process than knowing the evidence.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, one of the things that, and you're going to be enraged, James, is that
I started off enraged. I will be higher than that.
That's baseline, right, Jamie. Baseline.
Yeah. Enrage is my baseline. So you just go crazy.
Right. Super enraged. Bigger doses probably don't work better. And I know you love to use big doses.
Well, that's right. Yeah. We don't have a
lot to go on here, but aripiprazole and brexpiprazole have had some look at their doses, and it appears that kind of the bottom range, brexpiprazole 1 to 2 milligrams, aripiprazole up to maybe 5 milligrams, tends to probably be the optimal dose range to get effect. And as we know, usually that minimizes adverse events as well. But we don't have a lot of data, but what we have is pretty similar to what we see with antidepressants in general and a lot of symptomatic treatment, chronic pain medications, those types of things.
Yeah. And just so people, if you're within my field of view and you say the word lower doses, I become much calmer usually. But there are other potential treatments though for this, right?
Yeah. And of course you always need to talk about things like cognitive behavioral therapy, which has a response number needed to treat of about 5. So potentially half of what we see here with atypical antipsychotics, which is obviously in this case a good thing, right? Lower is better for NNTs. And remission probably similar, but probably on the lower range of also what you see with atypicals. And harms are, pretty avoidable with cognitive behavioral therapy. But I think a comment that comes up to me very often, especially when I'm talking about chronic pain or depression, is that depending where you are in the country, in Canada, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy may not just be easy to find. And so, I don't know your experience, Mike, with that and family medicine.
So there's a whole bunch of things. The first is that many patients will not want that. And I'm not quite sure why, but they'll even when offered for free on site, they'll decline the offer. But then there's, for those who are interested, it's getting funding for it. And then even if they have funding and they're interested, to find a therapist to do CBT versus just other types of talk therapy. So it's one of these things we all often say, oh, this is the way we should be managing most depression. We've talked about it for chronic pain. We've talked about it for a lot of things. And so we do have to recognize though that it's not simple to have our patients access this, because some will not want it, some will not have the funding, and some will have difficulty finding it.
Yeah. There are, of course, are other drug treatments. Mm-hmm. So bupropion has been looked at. It was compared to aripiprazole, and it looked like they were pretty close. So adding on bupropion versus adding on aripiprazole. Lithium, speaking of dirty drugs, has a response NNT of 5. But oddly, remission was similar to placebo. But I think we all know too that the lithium data is really, really old. It's old. So it's difficult to know what to do with that. And I'm not sure You know, certainly in my practice, not a lot of us are reaching for lithium to solve some of these problems.
Yeah. Well, then also, James was talking earlier about how we don't really know, and there is debates around SSRIs, for example. Are they really, is it really that they're delaying the reuptake of serotonin and that's how they're working? Because there's debate mm-hmm. about that. But anyhow, lithium is probably the one example that I use the most commonly as for how little we know about drugs, how they work, because lithium's been around for a long time for treatment of bipolar disorder and other conditions, and yet we don't. It's on the periodic table. It doesn't have really as much of a structure. Like, what receptor is that fitting into? And we don't really know how it works. And I'm not saying we need to. It's just interesting how long we've had a drug around that we still really don't know how it works.
And I also had another story, and I think I may have mentioned this on an earlier podcast, where the drug bupropion, I remember being at I think it was at one of our annual courses that we put on. We were discussing the use of antidepressants, and I think at the point we had, there was at least two, if not three, psychiatrists who were talking about it. And at that one point, they were male psychiatrists who were talking about it. And I just asked them the question, if you were depressed, which medication would you take? And all of them, they didn't even hesitate. They said bupropion. And it had nothing to do with anything to do with it was better or whatever. It just doesn't cause sexual dysfunction.
That's,
You know, so it's an interesting, we make decisions on with a variety of different things. Now, one of the things though is cost though, right, Jamie? And you guys do list a little bit of the cost of some of these things.
Yeah. Yep. For sure. So, looked at the three drugs that, have approval for depression being used for depression in Canada. So brexpiprazole. And it doesn't matter what dose of brexpiprazole you use, it's going to be about $110 for 30 days. So that is a bit tough to swallow, certainly. Aripiprazole, ranging anywhere from 2 to 15 milligrams, again, probably getting away with much lower doses than that, but $25 to $40 for 30 days. And then quetiapine, which has been around the longest, even if you use the XR formulation at 150 milligrams to 200, you're looking at $15 to $30 a day. So kind of aripiprazole and quetiapine.
No, probably. per 30 days.
Sorry, for 30 days. Yeah. Yeah. Again, cost is one of those things where you'll find patients that care very little, but you certainly find a lot for whom every dollar counts. And I think it comes into the equation anyway.
Yeah. And I always look, I don't know if any of these are tablets, and I just love the tablet dosing form because you can cut them. Whereas it's really, capsules are tricky.
They're a pain.
Yeah.
They're a pain to get around that issue.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Jamie, I think you talked about something here that happens in a lot of these trials, and you were discussing about the way that the patients get in, and they're, you know, and you were commenting earlier about how it's hard to know between the drugs which is more effective, and I couldn't agree more. The variations in the way these studies are designed, so that you might need to have failed two antidepressants before, and their criteria for in quotes failure is, you know, different than the next one that doesn't require it. Some will have you, well, you know, you were just on a drug, the third drug you tried was an SSRI, or the second drug you tried is an SSRI, and instead of switching you to something else and augmenting, we just augment. So that in itself, because the switch could add a few people to benefit. So there are so many ways that these trials can vary that make it, I will go as far as to say, almost impossible to determine is one of these drugs actually better than another without, it's an old article, but it speaks volumes about antidepressant treatments. And it was the title of the article, and I won't get it exactly right, but why does quetiapine beat olanzapine, which beats risperidone, which beats quetiapine?
Yeah.
And if you think about that, it's a circle that feeds on itself. It's every one of them can beat the other. And there's it's design of trial, who funded that trial. There's so many layers that make this. And so you, I'm leading you down the path of trying to sum it all up in a bottom line.
Yeah. So can you give us the definitive bottom line, which for which you have no doubt about? Right. And if you believe that, you need an antipsychotic.
Yes.
Go ahead, Jim.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And I don't think it matters which antipsychotic one chooses, but if you and your patient have I think tried an agent or two, an SSRI, SNRI, with a response that you don't feel is adequate, or adverse events that are resulting in a net benefit that's not a good one, adding an atypical antipsychotic to an agent that is working partially for about 30% of the patients, you will find that you can reduce symptom scores by probably about 50%. And knowing that 20% of people that would just stay on there, and in other words, get a placebo drug, would have a 50% response. So it's about a 20 versus a 30% response. And that's at 6 to 8 weeks. We don't really know beyond that, but it doesn't really matter which atypical you pick. But I think you can fine tune that a little bit by talking to your patients about the potential side effects and use the best predictability we have, which isn't great, about this one may cause more of this, this one may cause more of that, and then price at the end as well. I don't know if that, I think that probably sums it up.
Well, except in the bottom line, you don't mention lower dose and it's a little bit hurtful.
That was in there, James. I took it out, but not because it wasn't an important point, but just to hurt you.
Yeah, that you know, and it's why I'm so heavily medicated most of the time.
On hydrochlorothiazide too, I don't know what it's doing.
Yeah, yeah, 500 milligrams. I have no sodium in my body.
We call that a healthy dose.
Yeah, yeah. But no, that's great. I don't think there's a tools for practice that really is easy. There's so many challenges with this, and you know, obviously, kudos to the students who helped you and so on. It's really good, and it just gives all of the bottom line is the key thing, so that it helps you, at least clinicians, make a decision, because you're going to see people on this for this reason. Anything else you want to add, Jamie?
I think that's probably it. I think I've drained the tank of my knowledge.
Yeah, well, at least on this topic.
It took 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Jamie, did it come in? Was the tank on full, or where was the tank? Just wondering.
I don't know. It's my tank is always half full.
Yeah.
That's better. I'm driving on E most of the day.
Yeah, Mike has been running on fumes for a decade. But so given that we're just being completely rude to each other, Mike, anything you'd like to sell?
So, well, yes, it's not for me personally, James, but I'd like to mention CFPC Learn. Both for Tools for Practice, you can get credits through CFPC Learn there, but you can also get credits for this podcast and others simply by completing a short survey. The credits are directly entered into your account, so it's to make it as easy as possible for learning. And podcasts are a great way to learn, because you can do that while you're working out and you're driving, and they're a convenient way to do things, and there's a number of options on CFPC Learn.
Excellent. And then we would love it if you guys would join us. Jamie and I are chairing the conference this year in Vancouver, the Meme Conference, May 24th and 25th in Vancouver. It's usually lovely at that time of the year. I mean, it's lovely most times of the year, except when it rains, which is 6 months of the year. If you wanted to join us, go check out we've got all the speakers, we've got the topics, some really cool topics I think that you'll find interesting, and it's at hectalks.com is where you can find all that, hectalks.com, sort of a play on word on tech talks, but about health. We would love it if you could attend, and I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.